Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Find new food pyramid, but first, Iraqi insurgents launched two separate attacks on the country's oil industry in the north today, shooting at a convoy of tanker trucks and setting pumps on fire near Kirkuk. This as a suicide car bomb went off west of Baghdad, wounding several civilians. It was a deadly weekend in Iraq as well. Insurgents launched back-to-back attacks that killed nearly 30 people and wounded dozens of others. And on the political front, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Vice President Dick Cheney are stepping up pressure on the Iraqi government to end a three-month stalemate over forming a new government. Joining us on the line from Baghdad with the latest is Jill Carroll. She writes for the Christian Science Monitor. Jill, start by telling us, did Condoleezza Rice's call to new President Jalal Talabani spark any kind of progress? Jill?
Yeah?
I'm sorry, you apparently missed my question there. We're glad to have you there in Baghdad, and we wondered, Condoleezza Rice called on President Jalal Talabani to start some progress into forming a new government. Has anything happened? Oh, boy. Well, this happens when one calls Baghdad on occasion. Can you hear me now?
It does.
Okay.
A little better now.
Well, was there any announcement, any movement on a new government?
If you're asking if there's an announcement about the government, no, there hasn't been. There's still a lot of delays going on and a big division that kind of happened over the weekend between Ayad Alawi and the Kurds.
This is Jill Carroll trying to speak to us on the line from Baghdad. She writes for the Christian Science Monitor. Jill, if you can hear me, we'll call you back. Sometimes it's hard to get through, and we'll move to our other stories. And we will check back in Iraq, where we understand that if there isn't any progress on a new government with Ibrahim al-Jafari as the new president, the current prime minister, rather, that he may have to leave his post under the interim constitution. So obviously there's a lot of interest in whether or not there's going to be any movement in Baghdad by that date. We'll have more from Jill later in the program. But first, this morning, the racquetball and basketball courts, the pool lanes, the exercise equipment, all busy at the new fitness and recreation center at Boston University. Yet very few people working out had the new government guidelines on eating and exercise in mind.
I've read a few stories. It just seems too complicated. I don't see any problem with any of the old ones, to tell you the truth.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture released its long-anticipated new food pyramid last week. The icon is quite colorful, with a series of vertical bands representing the different food groups, most of the space going to fruits and vegetables, followed by grains, the smallest bands going to sugars, fats, and oils. And for the first time, the USDA has added another element, exercise. Von Desau is one of the trainers here at the club. First of all, I've got a picture of my pyramid here from the website, okay. And there's the little person running up the side. What do you think of that? I mean, what does that say to you?
I think it's finally great that the Food Guide Pyramid is taking into account both nutrition and exercise, because the one in 1992 didn't really take into account exercise as part of your lifestyle. I feel that it's great that it's taken into account that if you exercise more, you can allow yourself to have some more calories. But I think it doesn't take into account how, like, the vigorous, like, the type of exercise you do, the intensity.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, because I know in my gym, I look around and I see people, and sometimes me, just sort of looking at their watch, you know, getting in a half hour, but they're not really doing anything.
Right. If you look on the website, it tells you, it gives a list about how, like, what kind of exercises and how intense they should be.
How do they rate intensity?
Your heart rate. And how hard you're working, how you feel, like your exertion, if you're sweating or not.
Claire, I know that you're one of Vaughn's students here, and she's your trainer. And so we're just wondering if we could apply some of the new food pyramid thinking to you as you sit here on your cycle, your life cycle.
I would inform her that according to her active lifestyle, she probably exercises more than 60 minutes a day. So she's allowed to have a little more servings on the Food Guide pyramid than somebody who was inactive. So we would put her into the website and find out how many servings a day she should have. I think that it's great that they actually put that in, but I think it's a little confusing for people. As you said, they don't really know what's vigorous and what's moderate.
Have you looked at all, Claire, at the new food pyramid?
I haven't, actually. But I think there was a major criticism of the old food pyramid that it just simply had too many servings, and if most anyone actually ate as much food as they were suggesting, you would certainly gain weight. So this is probably an improvement.
Voices from the new recreation center at Boston University this morning. Well, in a moment, we're going to hear from a nutrition expert who is very critical of the pyramid. First of all, the fact that it's only largely available online, and he's suggesting one of his own pyramids. We'll have that in a moment. But first, joining us now, Roberto Salazar, the Food and Nutrition Service Administrator at the USDA. He oversees federally funded school lunch and food stamp programs that must follow the new guidelines. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And as you know, that many people are following the guidelines because they want to, including trainers. We just spoke with one. And you know it's been out about a week now, so the critics are weighing in. Let's get to some of the thoughts about the pyramid. We heard just heard from a trainer who was so excited that exercise was included. But the criticism is that it doesn't really explain how much, what kind, how high your heart rate should be.
Clearly, the new symbol is just that. It is a symbol. It is an icon. It is our new logo. It's intended to convey what would otherwise be potentially very complex information, to draw the attention of the American people to that complex information, to become informed and to become empowered about the importance of nutrition and exercise in your daily lives. This new symbol, called My Pyramid, is intended to convey three major points. First and foremost, that healthy choices need to be made from all the food groups. Second of all, we want Americans to balance what they eat with their physical activity, bringing in this new component of physical exercise as a major recommendation. And third and foremost, we want folks to get the most nutrition out of the calories that they consume.
Well, in addition to the food pyramid diagram, there's the interactive component online, and I went online to My Pyramid website and entered my information. It provided me with a personal plan. For instance, it tells me to aim for 5 teaspoons of oil a day. Now, some critics would say that you, the USDA, missed an opportunity here to tell people the difference between healthy oils, let's say a healthier olive oil, and harmful oils or fat.
Well, clearly we're not going to disparage food products. We are going to empower consumers with the knowledge of good nutrition.
Well, why not disparage food parts if they're bad for you?
Well, because who's to say that they are? Unless I've had the privilege of having my doctor assess me and understand what my medical and nutrition needs are, I think that's where I best would achieve that information.
But
certainly not going to rely on any website or any diet book to tell me that. I'm going to get good, sound advice. But what I am going to do is empower myself with the basic knowledge to understand what I should and shouldn't be doing and what questions I should be asking so that I have the knowledge and the power to ask the questions that you're asking. And that's, I think, a major step that we need to move forward for all Americans, because if we look at the history of the food guide pyramid, the previous pyramid, which some critics have suggested we should have stuck with, we recognize two facts. One, 80% of all Americans recognize the symbol, but regrettably, only 3% actually followed it. And so what we recognize is that we failed to empower Americans to inform themselves and to ask the right questions, the questions that you're asking today.
Well, but Roberto, there are some people who say there's a lot of science about what is bad food for you, trans fats, for instance, and this was a great opportunity to show that.
Well, and clearly, the food guide, dietary guidelines for all Americans do speak to the fact that you must reduce your trans fat consumption as well as your sodium consumption. And so the food guidelines, which are the science behind the symbol, do speak to what you should be doing in terms of a decreased intake of foods that may not be the most optimally healthy for you.
Well, I want to get back to a point you made earlier as well. You said, why should we disparage any food products? And some question how the USDA can be objective in providing information about nutrition when the agency is also responsible for protecting and promoting the food industry.
Well, I'm certain that the doctors, the nutritionists, the dietitians, those from the Institutes of Medicine who are heavily involved in the formation of these guidelines would beg to differ. These are scientists, these are individuals who spent a great deal of time over the past 2 years assessing the latest and greatest nutritional science and coming forward with these recommendations. And so in their defense, I would certainly have to say that I could not disagree with you more about that assessment.
There is a lot you can do on the website with My Pyramid, but not everyone can get to a website, including people who are most likely to have the worst eating habits, the low income, or people without access to computers.
Well, certainly we understand that not everybody will have immediate access to the Internet, but we also know that within the first 18 hours of launching this website, we had 48 million hits, so that tells me that clearly a large number of the American public do have access. We will continue to provide a wide array of printed materials and instruments that healthcare providers, dietitians, clinicians, and nutritionists can continue to use in advising Americans on their healthy eating habits.
There has been a lot of criticism of the pyramids. How are you feeling about that?
Well, no good deed goes unpunished. I've heard criticism from one spectrum all the way to the other. Some have suggested there's not enough information in this new symbol, that it's too simple. I've heard others suggest that it's much too complex, that we've included too much information. I'm looking, as we speak now, at a cartoon item that was in today's Washington Post that's labeled it the Rubik's Food Pyramid, suggesting that perhaps it's too complex and has way too much information. So we're seeing criticism from one end to the other, and I think that's a healthy thing because it calls attention to the new product.
Roberto Salazar, Administrator for the Food and Nutrition Services at the USDA. Roberto, thanks very much.
My privilege. Thank you.
And we're kind of glad he thinks it's a healthy thing. We'll hear more criticism of the food pyramid in a moment. But first, we want to go back to Jill Carroll of the Christian Science Monitor. She's in Baghdad, where there's been a day of violence and apparently no movement after pressure from the U.S. government on the Iraqi government to end a three-month stalemate over forming a new government there. Jill, tell us, nothing happened today. What does that mean?
Well, just so what's happening right now, we're seeing the latest reason for the delay is that I had a Lawi's group of supporters in the National Assembly has been demanding essentially what too much from the Shiites and the Kurds, who are the ones that are in charge of the whole government formation process, and so they've been asking for a lot of power that the Kurds and Shiites don't want to give them, and so now the Kurds and Shiites say, let's finish negotiating with you. We're going to go ahead with our own plan for the government and leave you out of it. But of course, this all tethers to a lot of violence on the ground here. People begin to feel that there's nothing happening of substance politically.
Is that what's happening? There's a sense that the insurgency has been reformed, reinvigorated. Is that what you feel is happening?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what it appears to be. We've had a significant drop in attacks on U.S. forces and sort of almost a lull, we could call it, in insurgent attacks after the election for several weeks. But as we slowly and been very, very slow to get the government formed, we're seeing an increase in attacks and insurgency. And, you know, insurgency can only exist when they have a certain level of local support, local people, at least complicit support. So people maybe are turning, reporting suspicious activity a little less and less reason to try to stop insurgents when they feel that the politicians they risked their life to vote for in January aren't doing much to really help them anyways.
And we understand that under the interim constitution, and we just have a few seconds left with you, under the interim constitution, if there isn't any progress by May 7th, the current prime minister has to leave his post. Any sense of who might replace him?
Right. Well, you know, I very much doubt that will happen. I'm sure the Shiites have a lot to lose. They would never, after everything had gone through, lose the submission they've gotten. So we'll see something will definitely happen eventually. But it'll probably be the last minute, as it always is around here. And the problem is, it does not bode well for writing a new constitution, which is the true work of this body.
Yeah. Jill Carroll writes for the Christian Science Monitor. She's based in Baghdad, where there are sometimes terrible phone lines. We're glad we got through to you, Jill. And thanks so much for keeping us up to date.
No problem. Thank you.
Stay with us. More on that food pyramid when we come back. About the USDA's new food pyramid. It was released last week. It's designed as a guide to healthy living for Americans, but according to many critics, it's way too vague and misses the mark on good nutrition. Well, joining us to hear more about the pyramid is Dr. Walter Willett. He's chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Willett, your thoughts on the pyramid?
Well, the new pyramid is unfortunately a huge lost opportunity to give Americans better guidance about healthy food choices. It really conveys, the pyramid itself, hardly any useful information.
Well, in fact, we understand that an early draft of the pyramid had words on it, you know, the word occasionally, for instance, next to foods like pastries or daily for good foods, but somehow those words disappeared. Is that what you mean? Would you have wanted more instruction?
Right. All you are given with the present pyramid is a series of colored bands. And the main message that comes through, perhaps, is that you're supposed to eat a lot of dairy products. And we're not even sure that that's safe in the long run. But it doesn't tell us what foods we should emphasize in our diets and what foods we should de-emphasize. And that's what people really need to know. I think it's probably not an accident that there's missing information there, because it's really a code of honor at the Department of Agriculture that you never say anything negative about a food, like eat less of it. You can say positive things, but you're not supposed to say anything negative.
Well, the makers of the pyramid, though, point out that it comes in 12 versions. It depends on a person's level of activity, caloric need, age, gender. And so people get to sort of fine-tune the pyramid and find the one that fits them. Isn't that helpful?
Well, that fine-tuning is really out of touch with reality. The people who designed this must have been from another planet. If you get online, you put in your age and your gender, and you're given details down to half ounces and fractions of cups and things like this. And even trained dietitians aren't that accurate in how they can estimate what they're eating. That's really not a way to live, and it really doesn't work in the long run.
You know, you mentioned that you felt the Department of Agriculture didn't want to say anything negative about any kind of food groups. Do you worry about the lobbying on the part of the food industry in making this pyramid?
Oh, we sure do. My Washington friends say the place at the Department of Agriculture was just abuzz with every commodity group out there trying to position themselves better on the pyramid. The role of the Department of Agriculture is first and foremost to promote American farm products. And those interests, those industrial groups are extremely powerful at the Department of Agriculture. And they are their first, what they call, stakeholders, not the health of the American public.
What about the pyramid that preceded this one? Were you a fan of that?
The pyramid that has now been replaced by the new pyramid was seriously out of date, and virtually everybody recognized that. It did give clear advice compared to what the new pyramid does. The problem was that it was bad advice.
What would you like to see in a pyramid? How do you think an American food pyramid should and could look?
Given the huge deficiencies in the USDA pyramid, my colleagues and I have put together an alternative pyramid. And right at the bottom, we do put healthy weight control and physical activity. That needs to be part of virtually everybody's day-to-day decisions about their diet and lifestyle. Then at the next level, we put healthy forms of carbohydrate, meaning whole grain, high-fiber forms, along with healthy fats. Then plenty of fruits and vegetables at the next level. Then emphasizing healthy sources of protein, chicken, fish, nuts, and legumes, for example. Then at the next level, some calcium sources. It could be either dairy products or calcium supplements. Dairy products are really not an essential part of the diet. Then up at the top are the things to be consumed sparingly. And there we put red meat and butter. They do have high amounts of saturated fat. And then refined grain products and sugar like white rice, white flour, white pasta, sweets, and, of course, soda.
I found myself thinking as this pyramid was much debated last week, well, who really makes their food choices based on, you know, the U.S. Department of Agriculture food pyramid? And I was astonished to hear how many teachers spoke about teaching with it in the classroom.
The food guide pyramid is not a straw man. It has major influence. First of all, it's widely out there on wrappers of packages, breakfast cereal boxes. Teachers use it in schools. And also, indirectly, it has a huge impact because many tens of billions of dollars every year of federal food programs have to be consistent with the food pyramid. And that means it influences millions of meals every day.
Also last week, a CDC study reports that people who are slightly overweight actually have less risk of death than people of normal weight. What's going on here?
Unfortunately, this is really recycled garbage. About 20 years ago, people thought they had discovered the same thing, that it was good to be overweight instead of what we call a healthy weight. The problem is that in this study and like other studies that have been done 20 years ago, the people who were chronically ill were not really removed from the healthy weight group in the analysis. And the reality is that many people lose weight from serious illness before they actually die. And if you don't take that into account, it makes it look like leaner people are actually at higher risk of dying.
So do not just read that first part of the sentence and think that being slightly overweight is okay.
No, we have dozens and dozens of carefully done studies that show that there are many adverse consequences of being overweight, and that includes a higher risk of type 2 diabetes, higher risk of heart attacks, postmenopausal breast cancer, colon cancer, kidney cancer, arthritis, and the list goes on.
Doctor, tell us the one thing that you think that Americans could eat less and make a dent in the huge problem of obesity linked to 112,000 deaths a year.
There's no one solution, of course, to the problem of obesity, but I think as a first step, if someone hasn't already done it, it would be to get calories from beverages out of our daily intake. The amount of calories that we consume as sodas and other sugar-sweetened beverages is huge, and that step alone for many people can make an important difference in their long-term weight.
Dr. Walter Willett, Chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you.
Good to be with you.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, the White House is sitting out on a limb on some controversial issues, Social Security, the case of Terri Schiavo, the nomination of John Bolton. Could Karl Rove be losing his Midas touch, or should his detractors still beware? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Is moving closer to a showdown over presidential nominees after last night's much-anticipated televised speech by Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Frist told religious conservatives at the Justice Sunday Stop the Filibuster Against People of Faith event that it's not radical to ask senators for an up or down vote on the president's long-stalled judicial nominees.
Either confirm the nominees or reject them, but don't leave them hanging. Don't leave our courts hanging. Don't leave our country hanging.
And event co-sponsor James Dobson of the group Focus on the Family made it clear that his followers are not just targeting Democrats. Dobson railed against the 9-member U.S. Supreme Court, 7 of whom were appointed by Republican presidents.
They're unelected and unaccountable and arrogant and imperious and determined to redesign the culture according to their own biases and values, and they're out of control.
Well, joining us on the line first from Washington, Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the LA Times. And Peter, you were at that event in Kentucky, and with the sound of James Dobson still in mind, there's a disconnect here. How is the Christian right getting away with attacking a nationwide judiciary that's largely Republican?
Well, in many ways, they feel that they've only recently come into their own in terms of political power. James Dobson talks about the message that evangelical Christians sent on November 2nd last year in the election, and in many ways they feel that it was the first election where they were respected and they were courted and where their power kind of showed itself.
And the fingers were pointed at other, I think they were called squishy Republicans?
Yes, they did. They named a few Republicans, John McCain, Lisa Murkowski, and it's not clear how any of those folks are going to vote. When it comes down to if Senator Frist goes ahead with the nuclear option, as it's called.
This nuclear option that you mentioned that Bill Frist is considering is, of course, his threat to do away with the Senate filibuster rules, allowing for a simple majority of Republicans who are now in office to confirm judges. Do you see him changing his position on that? Did he allude to anything last night that gave any wiggle room?
No, he didn't. He reiterated his threat. He did separate himself a bit from some in his own party, like Tom DeLay and even James Dobson himself, who have talked about ways to punish sitting judges whose rulings they don't like. Senator Frist said that he's happy to let courts know when he believes decisions are out of the American mainstream, but he does not believe in retaliation. And interestingly, the Democrats are threatening to shut down at least some aspects of business in the Senate. And the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, the Manufacturers Association, they don't want the Senate to be shut down. They want bills passed. So they're beginning to tell Senator Frist that. And the business community is, of course, another important facet of the Republican base.
Right. Getting back to this last night's event, again, you were there. What else stood out for you, and can you characterize it for us?
It was kind of an interesting mix of politics and religion. You know, there would be a political speech where they would quote Abraham Lincoln or the framers of the Constitution and talk about the role that the Senate plays should play in advice and consent on judges. But then they would turn around and they would pray and they would bow their heads and they would talk about the Bible. And there were even parallels drawn between judges who loosely interpret the Constitution and people who loosely interpret the Bible, and how they don't like either of those approaches.
Peter Walston, White House correspondent for the LA Times, talking about last night's Justice Sunday event in Louisville, Kentucky. Peter, thanks.
Thank you.
We turn now to John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, your thoughts, first of all, on the Justice Sunday event. Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a prominent Republican, criticized religious conservatives for what's seen as co-opting religion on this issue. Is this issue going to cannibalize the Republican Party?
Well, the challenge you have for a party is, how do you keep your base happy without making other people in the country think you've gone too far? Democrats experienced this problem in the last several decades when many voters in the middle of the spectrum decided that Democrats were doing too much to cater to minority groups, too much to cater to environmentalists and feminists and poor people, and that produced a reaction that benefited Republicans in presidential races and in the congressional races in the mid-1990s. That's what brought Newt Gingrich to power. Now it's Republicans who have to worry. They have some of their own moderate members speaking out saying, hey, wait a minute, we don't want a theocracy here. And that is sort of the voice of apprehension on the part of moderate Republicans that this coalition may be strained.
And we're going to have to see as the week plays out how some of the issues around this, the filibuster, the John Bolton nomination, how they play out. But in the meantime, are people, before we move on to other issues of the week, are people taking bets as to whether or not Bill Frist is going to pull the nuclear options? What's going to happen?
This is a very, very interesting question. I tend to think that if they had the votes to do this and really wanted to do it, they might have done it already. It appears that this is not going to happen this week. It might happen after this upcoming congressional recess. But I would still hold out the possibility, Robin, that we may get some sort of a compromise in which Democrats let some of these disputed nominees go through and hold up others.
On another subject, gas prices. Today, President Bush is meeting with the Saudi crown prince at the president's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Is anything going to come from that meeting?
Not clear. Probably talk. The president did indicate last week in an interview on CNBC that he thought that the Saudis were not pumping to the max, putting the most possible supply out there on the world market in a way that would ease some of the price pressure. But at least you give Americans the feeling that you're working on the problem, you hear what they're going through, you feel their pain, as Bill Clinton might have put it.
Well, some new wrinkles also today on continuing stories. Yesterday, the Washington Post reported that a lobbyist who's under investigation for impropriety used his personal credit card to pay for House Majority Leader Tom DeLay's trip to Britain. How damaging is this in the continuing story of Tom DeLay?
It's one more brick on the pile, as it were. None of these stories individually about Tom DeLay are sort of knockout blows for him, but the Republicans are reeling a bit from the bad publicity they've gotten on this.
We're speaking with John Harwood. And, John, it feels as if we've had these conversations before, that some of these stories that we are covering and have to cover are sort of stuck in gear. Any sense that there's going to be movement on anything this week?
Well, the Senate Finance Committee is taking up the Social Security plan this week. They're going to try to pass it through with Republican support only. And this could be real make-or-break time for the administration, because if they can't get this out with Republican votes out of the Finance Committee, they're going to have big problems. Democrats are staying pretty united against it. So they have a shot to get something going, but the sands are going through the hourglass, as it were.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And still to come, Billy Crystal's loving tribute to his uncle, the late Milt Gabler, famous in his own right as a recording genius. You're listening to Here and Now. week after Amtrak cut back service on its high-speed train because of brake problems, Congress is looking to put the brakes on Amtrak's $1.2 billion annual subsidy. President Bush has proposed legislation to overhaul the financing and management of intercity train travel. His bill would eliminate Amtrak's direct federal subsidy and is designed to increase competition in the passenger rail service. Here now, business reporter Mark Mills joins us to talk about proposed reforms to rail travel. Welcome, Mark, as always.
Thanks, Robin.
And, you know, we feel as if we've heard about proposals for reform in Amtrak before. Why is this happening now and what's different?
Well, the Amtrak system is losing a lot of money. The Bush administration feels it's a sinkhole. It's not going to get better and that something drastic needs to be done. And so this is not just a tinkering. This is a major overhaul. Amtrak was established 34 years ago as a for-profit national rail system, and it has never turned a profit and has received $29 billion in subsidies over that time. In 1981, Ronald Reagan called Amtrak a mobile money-burning machine. And today, this government, this administration, sees it pretty much the same. Critics say it's too bureaucratic, wasteful, inefficient. The president favors a more market-based approach, with states having a major say in what kind of service their region receives.
And we're going to get to what opponents of his legislation say. But first of all, tell us, how would the proposed reforms achieve what the president wants?
Well, the Bush proposal would create regional commissions of states that would oversee rail travel in their area. For example, in the Northeast Corridor, by far the busiest in the country, a commission of eight states plus the District of Columbia would make the key decisions about what kind of service they want, the routes and the timetables and whatnot. And Amtrak would have the right to compete with other railroads to get contracts to provide that service in the regions. The railroads would just operate the trains. They would not be responsible for maintaining the rail beds and train stations the way Amtrak does now. The regional commissions would split the cost of infrastructure improvements with the federal government, and the states would be responsible for providing any subsidy for service that was not self-supporting.
Okay, now to the opponents of the president's proposed legislation. Don't train fans have the right to gripe? Gee, they pour so much money into the airlines and into roads. Why not trains?
Well, that is one of the arguments. Critics of the proposal say in the long run, this places too big a burden on the states, and that in time, states would be unable to subsidize the service and passenger rail would be curtailed. They say this is a national transportation issue and that Amtrak has never been given the resources it needs to provide a high level of service, that it's always been sort of on a starvation diet and been programmed to fail. Advocates for intercity passenger service say it's critical to keep a high level of train service, particularly in the heavily traveled Northeast area where roads are clogged and airports are busy. They say nothing should be done to jeopardize the passenger train alternative.
And, you know, people wonder why train travel in the U.S. is nowhere near as good as it is in Europe or Japan. And the question, is it even possible to run a profitable, you know, high-quality train service in the U.S.? Why? What
well,
is that?
You know, that is debated all the time, Robin, and clearly the service is much better in Europe and Japan. They say that the advocates for trains here say successful train service in Europe and Japan is heavily subsidized, and they point out that the U.S. puts $40 billion a year into subsidies for roads and mass transit and that we should expect to support intercity train travel at a higher level if we want a first-rate system like our some of our trading partners. The Bush administration says the current model is unworkable, that it's failing. They say competition will bring more efficiencies into the system and that if states have a bigger stake in how the trains run, they will make the right decisions on what level of service they want and are willing to pay for. A lot of this, Robin, is really philosophical. Conservatives tend to favor market solutions and local authority. Liberals tend to favor a more collective approach with federal subsidies.
Okay. Well, as if we couldn't see that. So where does the legislation stand now?
Well, the Bush administration just formally presented its bill to Congress on April 14th, so this is pretty fresh. Amtrak has issued its own proposal, and theirs, however, calls for increasing the federal subsidy. So cutting off Amtrak's funding would be difficult for a lot of members of Congress because so many states do receive service. 46 states actually get some kind of Amtrak service. So the Bush administration faces a bit of a climb in getting its bill passed. And the question really will come down to whether to make a bigger commitment to Amtrak or to have a system of competition and state control. That's what's at stake in the debate.
And we will assign you to keep an eye on that, Mark.
I'll watch it.
Thanks so much. Here now, business reporter Mark Mills.
Thanks, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. new CD and DVD, Billy Crystal presents the Milt Gabler story, might at first glance seem an unusual pairing. Billy Crystal, the actor and comedian, Milt Gabler, the successful music businessman, record producer, and impresario. But Milt Gabler was also Billy Crystal's uncle, and the CD-DVD is the nephew's loving tribute.
Milt was the celebrity in the family when I was a kid. Milt is the live wire, and he was loud and boisterous, great sense of humor, and he would come back with legendary stories of who he had just recorded. And the whiff and breath of this guy's career, as I came to know it, you know, as I grew older, is extraordinary.
Joining us in the studio to learn more about the relationship and the music, here and now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Welcome, James.
Hi, Robin.
And Billy Crystal speaks of his uncle in his one-man show, 700 Sundays. That's Billy Crystal's current show on Broadway, which is very hard to get into.
Impossible.
But we learn from the DVD what he thinks of his uncle.
He thinks the world of his uncle, Milt Gabler, because Milt Gabler, in a way, gave Billy Crystal at least the idea of getting into show business. Milt Gabler associated with people like Louis Armstrong and Billie Holiday and Bing Crosby and on and on and on.
Let's listen to more of Billy Crystal on his uncle from the new DVD.
When you're a kid, you come home and Milt's over, and he's telling you, I just was with Sammy Davis Jr., and I just recorded Bing Crosby, and oh yeah, Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald and the Weavers, and it's the history of music of that period of time.
James Isaacs, who was Milt Gabler?
Milt Gabler was born in New York in the year 1911. He died in the year 2001. His father owned an electronics/hardware store on 42nd Street in New York. And Milt Gabler convinced his dad that it might not be a bad idea, and perhaps they could even make a little money, if they started selling records. So what Gabler did was acquire some old ARC titles. This was a budget label.
It was sold in dime stores.
That is correct, mm-hmm. Yes. And Gabler ordered special repressings of the out-of-print labels. And from there, he started what turned into, the first mail-order record label. And then a few years later, Milt Gabler said to himself, we can record people and we can start our own record company, which turned into Commodore Records. Commodore is notable for several things. The quality of the music, first of all. Again, it's traditional jazz and swing. They were the first independent jazz label, and they were the first to list personnels on the label. Milt Gabler so admired and respected the musicians that he wanted you to know who was playing what instrument. Other labels hadn't done that up to that point.
Commodore's first release, a song, Love is Just Around the Corner, by Eddie Condon.
Eddie Condon and his Windy City 7 from 1938, the very first Commodore record.
Milt Gabler, Billy Crystal's uncle, would go on to be connected to some of the most influential jazz releases and pop releases of the century. But some would say one of the most influential songs of all time, the song Strange Fruit. Remind us about that recording.
Strange Fruit was a poem set to music. Billie Holiday recorded it in 1939, but getting it recorded was not easy in the least. A very controversial subject, lynchings in the South. No one wanted to touch this song. Milt Gabler said, let's do it. And when you hear Billie Holiday's haunted voice and the subtle, effective backing of the musicians, including the pianist Sonny White, well, then you understand why years later, Time magazine called Strange Fruit the song of the 20th century.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Milt Gabler's recording of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. And, you know, so he had an ear. He knew what
was
important.
He had huge ears.
Right.
In the DVD, Billy Crystal says he had elephant ears.
He knew what was good. But his name was also attached to songs that were good. Did he write?
Well, I don't know that he did. I don't know that he didn't. It was not an uncommon practice during those days, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, for influential record producers like Gabler to have his name affixed to the song title. So you see Milt Gabler's name on a Nat King Cole hit called Love, which is in this collection. You also see his name under the title of Wayne Newton's Donkashane. And on the song that we're about to hear, Milt Gabler's name again appears. This is Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five. The year is 1946, and Choo Choo Chibugi has that train rhythm that's just irresistible. It's a wonderful song, and here it is.
You reach your destination, but alas and alack, you need some compensation to get back in the black. You take a morning paper from the top of the stack and read the situation from the front to the back. The only job that's open needs a man with a knack, so put it right back in the rack, Jack. Choo-choo, choo-choo, chibugi, woo-woo, woo-woo, chibugi, choo-choo, choo-choo, chibugi, take me right back to the track, Jack.
Now let's look at the lineage. Billy Crystal's father married Milt Gabler's sister.
Younger sister.
And then Billy Crystal's father sort of moved into spaces as Milt Gabler left them.
And that happened because Milt Gabler was signed by a man named Jack Capp, who ran Decca Records, one of America's premier major labels. Milt Gabler was signed to be an A&R man, artist and repertoire, and eventually an executive vice president. He also expanded his musical purview, I guess you could say. Not just jazz anymore. He went into the fields of country music, rhythm and blues, very commercial pop music.
Well, in 1993, Milt Gabler was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Billy Crystal did the honors. Milt Gabler would also be inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. But Billy Crystal has said that when he got up there on the stage and listed his uncle's credits, these rock and rollers were just gasping.
Yeah, like so, Eric Clapton wanted to meet him immediately after the ceremony.
Well, remind us, just tick off some of the accomplishments, the people he worked with.
Well, there was Lester Young, the great cool tenor saxophone player, Bing Crosby, Louis Jordan and the Timpani Five, Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. Gabler was the first to put them together as a vocal team. Peggy Lee recorded for Milt Gabler, and on and on and on. And then, in 1954, Milt Gabler was in the studio, behind the glass, as the producer of what turned out to be the rock and roll shot heard round the world, Bill Haley and His Comets, Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight.
Bill Haley and the Comets singing Rock Around the Clock, produced by Milt Gabler, also known as Billy Crystal's uncle.
And Milt Gabler continued to have hits. In 1970, I think the year was, he produced the soundtrack of Jesus Christ Superstar. So there you go, many decades as an all-round record man, a species that no longer exists in the world of music.
And many reasons for Billy Crystal to be proud. His new CD is called Billy Crystal Presents the Milt Gabler Story from Strange Fruit to Rock Around the Clock. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. James, thanks so much.
Robin, thank you. And one last word. I urge the listeners out there to get the DVD version, because I've watched it twice, and I got to admit, I got misty both times. It's just so wonderful, loving, and the anecdotes and the footage, invaluable stuff. Billy Crystal and Milt Gabler, my hat is off to you both.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Ivins.
Well, it's 8, 9, 10, 11, 2, I'll be going strong, and so will you. We're going to rock around.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Ann Stevenson. And our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.